It is just past 9 p.m. in the Russian capital, Moscow. This is Press TV's World News with me, Waqar Rizvi. The U.S. President's former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, has pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russia. Flynn was speaking at an appeals court in Washington, D.C. He admitted that Donald Trump's transition officials directed his contacts with the Russians. He also acknowledged that he had knowingly made false statements to investigators in this regard. Flynn was charged with willfully lying to FBI prosecutors about his private discussions with former Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Klisyak, during the transition period. He is the most senior official indicted in a probe into possible collusion between Donald Trump's presidential campaign and Russia. The White House says Flynn's plea clears the way for a prompt conclusion of the investigation. Joining us live now from Washington is Mr. James Jatras, who is a former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst. Mr. Jatras, thanks for joining us. How do you react to Flynn essentially admitting that he did have contacts with Russians?
Well, of course, we knew he had contact with the Russians, but what he's pleading guilty to is lying about those contacts to the FBI. And I just have to say, this is unfortunately kind of the sleazy tactics we expect out of some of the prosecutors we find, Mr. Mueller and some of his associates, who, let's be honest, can convict anybody for lying to the FBI or making false statements. All they have to do is batter you with enough questions so they catch you in some kind of inconsistency, and then they charge you with many decades worth of time in jail if you don't plead guilty to something. So any kind of inconsistency or vagueness of your response turns into willful lying and a criminal penalty. And if you know what's good for you, you plead guilty, because if you go to trial, you're going to spend the rest of your life behind bars. That's the way this works, and that's the way they're putting the squeeze on Flynn and also threatening his son with the same thing.
Mr. Jatras, you know, the White House says that this should now conclude the investigation, or should be one of the concluding steps to this investigation into Russian collusion, or sorry, Trump's collusion with Russia to win the elections in 2016. Do you feel that way as well?
I don't know. I mean, look, collusion, there's no crime in the U.S. code called collusion. And it's perfectly reasonable for a campaign, or certainly for a transition team, to be in contact with any foreign government, because it's the president's job to conduct foreign relations. There's no indication that the Russians interfered in our election at all, despite the hysteria coming from the American media. The trouble is that with Flynn now, quote, being flipped, does he have anything to offer them? Does he have anything to offer that actually constitutes a crime? And I'm afraid what this will simply lead to is more politicization, saying, aha, collusion, collusion, even though there's really no crime that's been committed.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask you about that as a final point. Then what happens going forward then? This is a story that just isn't dying down.
We really don't know. And that's why I think that what's wrong with this whole process is that the only way Mueller can justify his existence is nailing scalps to the wall. He got George Papadopoulos. Now he's got Flynn. He wants to get the president. This is the only way he can show that his operation has any validity to it. And whether the facts of the law actually conform to that is really secondary, because there's an awful lot of people, certainly on the Democratic side, and too many on the Republican side too, that would be more than happy to find some excuse to get rid of Trump.
Very well, Mr. Jatras, we'll leave there at that, but of course, as always, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Russia has strongly condemned the recent U.S. threats against North Korea as a, quote, bloodthirsty tirade. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Washington is playing with fire when it says North Korea will be utterly destroyed in the event of a war. Lavrov was referring to a speech by U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, following the recent missile launch by North Korea. The Russian foreign minister added that Moscow will do its best to prevent a war on the Korean Peninsula. On Tuesday, Pyongyang test-fired a new ballistic missile that it says can reach the entire U.S. mainland. Now, Syria has condemned the Saudi-backed opposition for demanding President Bashar al-Assad be removed from power.
We have a big problem in this round of talks. The problem stems from the Riyadh 2 statement. The language with which the statement was drafted is seen by us, Syrian government, as well as by too many capitals, as a setback rather than a backward setback, rather than a progress forward.
Bashar Jaafari made the remarks on the sidelines of the UN brokered peace talks in Geneva. He said the Syrian opposition has used, quote, provocative and irresponsible language. Senior Syrian diplomats stressed that the group's preconditions violate the principles of the peace negotiations. He also said the Syrian delegation will leave the Geneva peace talks on Saturday and decide whether to return to the negotiating table or not. The previous rounds of talks between the Syrian government and the opposition have failed to yield positive results, mainly due to differences over the fate of the Syrian president. Police in Bahrain have used force to disperse protesters voicing support for Shia cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. The police fired tear gas at protesters in the villages of Abu Saiba and Shahura. Similar rallies have been held in other villages as the health of Sheikh Qasim, who is under house arrest, is deteriorating. Protesters are demanding that the 80-year-old cleric be given access to immediate medical care. Sheikh Qasim has been living under virtual siege since the regime revoked his citizenship in June 2016, prompting protests and sit-ins in his hometown of Diraz.
Look, I know I pissed off a lot of people over the years, many of whom are in this room right now. But I think that's what good investigative reporting does. It ruffles feathers. But I was never fired. And my editors never threw me under the bus. And that's because I never wrote anything until now that really mattered to a lot of people. Mattered in a scary way. I'm not going to take it back, make nice, save my job. Because I thought my job was to tell the public the truth, the facts, pretty or not, and let the publishing of those facts make a difference in how people look at things, at themselves, at what they stand for. This is the only thing I ever wanted to do.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A prisoner drinks poison and dies at a kangaroo court in The Hague, convened by NATO, the real war criminals of Yugoslavia. The dramatic suicide of Bosnian Croat leader Slobodan Praljak at the Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia in The Hague, just as his appeal against a 20-year sentence that would most likely have seen him die in prison. Also, the accession of the Zimbabwe throne of former intelligence chief, then Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, to much jubilation by the BBC and the rest of the corporate media, but concerns today that he's appointed Zimbabwe Army generals to several key cabinet jobs. Could the military have been plotting behind Robert Mugabe's back? Perish the thought. And alongside news that tens of thousands of unofficial US troops remain on the ground in Syria comes the ominous news that China is readying ground troops to send to Syria too, in an attempt to prevent Britain's Ministry of Defence and the Pentagon reigniting the removal of Syria's President Assad after the demise of their al-Nusra and ISIS proxies. Last weekend's massive attack on a Sinai mosque left over 350 worshippers dead in Egypt. Still nobody's claimed the attack. How could the Egyptian military allow a squad of 20 to 30 gunmen to wander around their country? So what was the purpose? Who had the means and the motive? And just down the road, Saudi's unofficial king, Mohammed bin Salman, continues to use British and American jets and bombs and RAF personnel to massacre Yemeni civilians. But the EU to the rescue. banning arms sales to Saudi Arabia now. Also revisiting Libya tonight, from the best social services, living conditions and infant mortality rate in Africa to regular massacres and now even slave markets. In 5 short years, we revisit the bloody and illegal regime change invasion orchestrated mainly by the British and the French militaries. But Martin, let's first start with this news about the former Yugoslavia and this suicide, dramatic suicide in court this week.
Yeah. Obviously, I don't know all the detail about what this guy's supposed to have done. But you've got to remember that the Croats back in the day, and I was an aid worker in former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, they were largely aligned with the West. So I would imagine that this guy has probably been hung out to dry as a sacrificial lamb, because the International Criminal Court in The Hague had to be seen to be reasonably even-handed.
This is a tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, this particular angle.
And of course, I had quite a lot to do with the Croats when I was over there, because I was working for a Catholic organisation.
Just take us back. When were you there and what were you doing?
Well, I worked for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development as their East European desk officer. And just as I got into post, the war in Yugoslavia broke out. So Yugoslavia became a large chunk of what I was doing, which involved, you know, frequent visits to the region and trying to understand what was going on.
But you weren't actually based over there?
No, I was based in London, but I used to fly out on a Monday and come back on a Friday. So it was actually quite close.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about the early 90s.
And give us your short version of what happened there, because NATO were very much involved. I mean, you were saying that you didn't think initially that that the West was doing it deliberately, but you later came to the conclusion that it was.
Well, it seemed to me at the time that they'd made a complete mess of handling the situation, and that's what it allowed. And of course, underlying all of this had been the fact that Yugoslavia was in debt. It was the communist country that was most in debt from the international banks, and that the repayment schedules that those banks were demanding created impossible strains within the Yugoslav political system, which wasn't capable of managing those strains, because you had a very divided... Yugoslavia was united in one way, but divided in another way, ethnically and linguistically, obviously, but also just by level of development.
I'm trying to remember...
Slovenia in the north of Yugoslavia is, to all intents and purposes, a West European country.
I'm trying to remember, didn't Tito die in the late... Is it 1979 or something? So it was a long time before... Yeah. Another 10 years, really, before things started to fall apart.
They carried on for a while, but the things started to deteriorate for various reasons. Underlying it was the debt problem, and also the collapse of the Soviet Union had an effect in Yugoslavia, a kind of demonstration effect.
So various people were saying, well, this is because it's one Yugoslavia, we want to be our separate country, a bit like Catalonia.
Yes, but not dissimilar, because Slovenia was a relatively prosperous part of Yugoslavia, and they felt that they were being held back by the people in the south, the Serbs and the Kosovans. Of course, Serbs and Kosovans are historically antagonistic to each other, but from the Slovenian-Croatian point of view, they're all poor people from the south of the country that we don't really want to carry anymore.
What was the CAFOD's role in all this, Catholic Fund for Overseas Development?
Well, what happened, because people were seeing terrible pictures on the TV and so on, the Catholic faithful in Britain had raised quite a lot of money to be spent to help the people who were suffering.
Well, that sounds great, but not all that money was finding its way to aid, was it?
No, the money I was spending was largely spent on what I wanted it to be spent on. But what was going on, actually, is a lot of the money that was being raised was being spent on just keep feeding people in refugee camps. And, of course, even if you've got a lot of money, it doesn't take long for it to go through.
You have quite a lot of discretion about who you were giving money to. You must have been the most popular man in that part of the world.
Well, no, you're not actually popular, especially with the Croats, because they were dependent on our funding for doing the projects they were doing, and we were demanding that, you know, they were accountable with the money that they were spending, and that they were spending it in a non-sectarian way, so that they weren't just helping Catholics with
our money. I'm trying to come to here, Martin, some of your money must have gone on sectarian things, like, for example, in Kosovo.
No, I don't agree with that at all, Tony. And I think most of the money was actually spent on food aid. Although we did have a very interesting project, which I helped to set up in Mostar, where after the ceasefire, There was a factory in East Mostar which produced juice, and a dairy in West Mostar which was under Croatian control which produced milk. And in cooperation with other organisations, we set up, we put both factories back into operation because they'd been out of operation during the conflict, and they produced milk and juice. And then every family in the Mostar region received a pint or a litre of milk and a litre of juice every day. And the two sides had to cooperate together in order for that to be fulfilled.
So you were banging heads together, really?
That's basically what we were doing. I remember going to one meeting, and I was late to the meeting, and there was lots of people in the meeting, and I was the last one in there. And of course, it disturbed everybody for me coming in. I felt really embarrassed. I'm the last one in here. Couldn't say sorry. So excuse me, just getting in the back. Anyway, I sat there listening to the meeting through translation, and I realised that the two sides are only talking to each other because people like us were there. They wouldn't have talked to each other if we weren't there. And that was what the job was. We were trying to get people to see reason and to try and negotiate solutions to the problems.
Okay, so why did Slobodan Praljak take poison?
Well, I presume he didn't want to spend 20 years in prison, as you suggested when you introduced the piece. You know, if you're getting on.
I mean, surely he's sending a sign to Yugoslavs today saying that I'm prepared to die for this cause that I was fighting for in those days. And I don't trust this court. I believe it's a kangaroo court. Is it a kangaroo court?
Well, no, it is a kangaroo court in one way, because it's largely been directed at the Serbs, who are the Croats' enemies. Although the Croats carried out massive ethnic cleansing of Serbs and Bosnians. But of course, the Croats were part of our alliance. We helped the Croats. The Croats were the most aligned with the West. And when I went through the Krajina just after the Croatian army had gone through the Krajina, which is a Serb part of Croatia, and everybody had been driven out.
But it reminds loads me, of you know what this reminds me a little bit of is the whole thing with Saddam Hussein actually working very closely with the West, and then suddenly he's put. You know, actually he was killed, wasn't he? But I mean,
he was hanged.
Basically taking them through this process to get them out of public circulation because they know all about the people that they've been working with in the past with the West.
Well, what you'll find, he's probably from the, I would guess that this guy's probably from HOS or one of the other groups of the right-wing paramilitaries that operated in Croatian right-wing paramilitaries. I'm guessing, or you might, I don't know enough about the actual case.
What about the NATO side? Because they haven't been prosecuted.
Well, no, and of course they've been supporting all sorts of things. One of the major country that isn't in the International Criminal Court system, the United States of America, because they know if they were in part of the system, their people would have
but
to
Britain
stand trial.
But Britain is. Why isn't Tony Blair being tried?
What the British would say to the Americans is you can join the International Criminal Court system because it's rigged anyway and none of our people will ever have to stand trial. In actual fact, the war in Yugoslavia is relatively small beer compared to what's happened in the Middle East. But of course, it's all these low-level gangsters like this guy, and I suspect he probably was a bit of a gangster, who get put in front of the court. And of course, the really senior US generals and others who ought to be in front of the court will never go to them in front of that court.
What do you make of the last couple of weeks in Zimbabwe then? Because we've seen this former intelligence chief, and then he became the vice president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa. He's now, I mean, we've seen so much. I mean, John Simpson from the BBC sort of cheering and stuff. Oh, God, we've got rid of Mugabe. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it wonderful? And they haven't really been telling us anything about this guy, but now it seems today he's been appointing generals from the army to his cabinet.
Well, I mean, the situation is obviously ongoing, and if you want my analysis of it, I'll try and give it you in a nutshell. The army are a key institution in Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army fought a textbook battle to defeat the Rhodesian regime, and they succeeded in doing so. And then,
did they have help from outside?
Yeah, they did. They were trained by the Chinese army. I used to know people who were involved. They were trained by the Chinese army in Mozambique, although the Russians were training ZAPU forces in Zambia, but they were less effective because they had more sophisticated weaponry, but they didn't have the political training that the ZANLA were given. And there's always been a bit of a tension between the army in Zimbabwe and Mugabe, because Mugabe wasn't really a military leader. He was a political leader, and the army, some in the army always felt that Mugabe came to power on the back of their sacrifices. And Tongogara, who was the leader of the ZANLA, died in a very mysterious car accident in the last week of the war. And I would suggest that in other circumstances, he would have made a much better leader for Zimbabwe than Mugabe turned out to be. So there's always been a bit of a tension between Mugabe and the army. Now, what's happened here, I think, is interesting, because the army has removed Mugabe rather than some kind of mass uprising. There's two sides to this. One is a positive side. That means that there hasn't been a mass uprising with loads of people killed and so on. It's been a relatively bloodless coup. The negative side of that is that there's continuity in the situation, and the army are obviously going to use the fact that they removed Mugabe as a means of protecting themselves from further change, which they find unpalatable. But I would suggest also that the Zimbabwean army is unlikely to go along wholeheartedly with IMF policy, for example, for Zimbabwe, whereas the MDC opposition, who are the civilian opposition, are in fact more likely to go along with IMF policy. Now, the BBC cheerleaders want Zimbabwe just to become a normal African country that does what the IMF wants. But I suspect the way this is playing out is that there will be continuity as well as change, and that some of the things that the Mugabe regime was doing will continue, because the army are, to some extent, implicated in what Mugabe was doing. So they're not going to change at all.
This guy, particularly as intelligence chief, has been apparently responsible for various massacres, but we weren't told that when John Simpson and the BBC were cheering about the overthrow of Mugabe.
Well, no, I mean, but the point is, if you want Mugabe out, somebody's got to remove him, and this guy's got the political...
But he's got ZANU-PF. Surely they could just have an election?
There is going to be an election next year. The army have said we're going to have an election, and the MDC will obviously stand probably Tsvangirai against whoever ZANU-PF bring up. But of course, it's been presented in the West that ZANU-PF doesn't have popular support, and that isn't the case. There's a bit of a split in Zimbabwe between the urban areas, which tend to be pro-MDC, and the rural areas, which tend to be pro-ZANU-PF. And ZANU-PF hasn't disappeared as a political party. It's still, it was ZANU-PF's central committee which voted to remove Mugabe.
Okay, let's go through some of these new cabinet appointments today. Then there's, first of all, Sibusiso Moyo, who's a general who became the face of the recent military takeover. He's the new foreign minister, so he was in charge of the coup that wasn't supposed to be quite a coup for legal reasons. So he's now defence minister. And there are various others. I mean, it does seem as if this is just the vice president sitting down, maybe on Skype or whatever, with a bunch of people at the top of the army saying, let's just get rid of Mugabe and I'll take over for you.
Well, I think the reason why they moved when they did is because Mugabe's about to shuffle off this mortal coil, but a bit like Mao Zedong and Jiang Xing, his young wife, Grace, was setting herself up to be, Mugabe too. And then, of course, because she's relatively young, then that would have been going on for a very long time. At that point, the old guard in the army said, well, we can't just have her taking over from the old man because we'll be stuck with her forever.
Sibusiso Moyo was the leader of an elite military unit known as the Green Berets Squad. The head of the Zimbabwe's Air Force, Perence Shin, he's been named the Minister of Agriculture and Land Affairs. He's notorious for having led the military operation against opponents of Mugabe in Matabele land in the early 80s. What was that about?
Well, what was happened is that the Ndebele in the south of the country generally tended to support ZAPU rather than ZANU, and the orientation of their guerrillas was towards what was then the Soviet Union as opposed to China coming through Mozambique. And in theory, there was a unity government, but in practice, they felt that the Shona, who were the majority tribe in the country, were squeezing them out. And of course, historically, the Ndebele had been dominant over the Shona, so that they didn't like the idea of becoming second fiddle. So that then, of course, the North Korean trained 5th Brigade went into the southern provinces around Bulawayo and carried out some pretty atrocious repression of the population in order to get them into line with the new regime.
Well, that's not really acceptable, is it, for the agricultural minister to be behind the massacre of an estimated...
Well, you've got...
Martin, an estimated 20,000 civilians were killed there.
Yes, and lots of civilians were killed by the white minority regime before the
but
war ended.
But is it
ended.
Appropriate for these people to be in ministerial positions?
Well,
now?
No, I think
it's a reward, isn't it?
No, no. What you've got to recognise is that they would be in powerful positions, whether they're in ministerial positions or not. What we've had in Zimbabwe, and I'm putting, you know, fingers crossed, they can have a non-violent change of regime and a change of atmosphere, which will allow the opposition to do what they want to do and try and you know, steer the country in the direction they would like it to be in, but without a massive upheaval, which is actually not in anybody's interest. In certain political situations, you just have to look for incremental change in the right direction rather than a complete Arab Spring type scenario, which then leads to a civil war, as we've seen in other parts of the world.
Well, critics around Africa and around the world are saying that Mr. Mnangagwa has just simply rewarded people who helped him become president with giving them cabinet jobs. Is that normal?
I think it is when coups take place. I mean, this is a coup, don't forget. This is not an election, and therefore you reward the people that helped you to carry the coup out. Because otherwise it could have turned into a shooting match between different factions with a lot of people killed.
Or else Mugabe may have just retired normally in the presidential elections next
year.
No,
because Grace Mugabe was setting herself up, as I explained earlier, to be the new incarnation of the old fella.
I mean,
and that's why they've moved now.
Isn't it normal for Mugabe to be thinking, well, actually, I'd rather have Grace or a civilian doing this job rather than the military running the country?
Well, it's also in defiance of the ZANU-PF party. Now, we talk a lot about Zimbabwe, and this is quite deep. Detailed level of discussion we're having, but we don't talk about countries like Malawi, which have had a dictatorship regime for years and years and years, killed loads and loads of people, but they do what the IMF wants.
Are we going to get a fair election, do you think, in Zimbabwe next year?
That's a big question, and a lot of people are going to be looking to see if we get a fair
I was
election.
Looking, for example, this week at the Honduras election, the presidential elections in Honduras, with actually guffawing, watching the... Because they had a some kind of live feed, which was showing what the results were from the counts in Honduras, and the live feed went out, and... When it came back on again a few hours later, another complete result. It was just one of the candidates was doing well, sort of 5 or 10% ahead. And then when the live feed on people's computer screens and on the TV came back, it was the opposite. The other guy was doing really well.
Yeah, well, the history of Honduras is very interesting because the Zelaya regime, which was aligned with the left in Latin America, was overthrown by a military coup supported by the Americans. Obama was the president, and then they went and murdered their opposition, including green activists and so on. And it was all supported by the US, overthrowing the democratically elected government. And this new government, which has just cheated in the election, as you just pointed out, is a pro-Western government. So we're not going to hear anything about that on the BBC. Zimbabwe's on the BBC because they're a whipping boy for the Western powers.
Well, right,
we don't hear about what goes on in other parts of Africa where you've got stable pro-Western regimes, which are every bit as bad as Mugabe's regime, if Mugabe's regime is that bad.
Honduras.
But we don't hear anything about them. Honduras, you've got a pro-Western regime, which is actually a coup regime brought in by the military, supported by the US.
But they've had an election, which apparently didn't go the way they wanted.
Yeah, but the election's been rigged. That's the whole point.
Riot police in Honduras clashed with supporters of the main opposition contender in the presidential election, Salvador Nasralla, after he accused the electoral court of fraud. I mean, the fraud was there for everyone to see on the TV screens, for anyone in Honduras, as the screen flashes off and it flashes back. All's well that ends well
in Honduras, because we've now got a stable right-wing regime aligned with the United States of America. And that's what we need to see all over Latin America, isn't it? Let's get rid of all these leftist people and bring in sensible, middle-of-the-road people who are going to carry out IMF policy without a fuss. And that's why we have coups, and that's why we have rigged elections. But we don't hear about coups and rigged elections as long as the result is what we want to see.
We had something similar in Kenya, didn't we, with the cancelled election, a rerun, and then the person that called for the rerun didn't stand in the new election. This sounds to me like an intentional destabilisation.
Well, there's
outside forces involved here.
Well, there's usually outside forces involved in all of these things, because it's not just an internal matter in any of these countries. There's a global struggle going on between the Anglo-Zionist establishment and the Russian and Chinese opposition, which is gradually developing, and everybody else is when the elephants make love, the ants get crushed, or as when the elephants fight, the ants get crushed. That's what's going on all over the world. And what's very insignificant to me is that we are certain places we are told to care about and worry about. And did you see, for example, this week on BBC4, there was yet another eulogy to the White Helmets operating in Aleppo and what great heroes they were, etc.
I thought they'd been totally discredited.
Well, indeed, there's a very interesting...
This is smacking of really sophisticated propaganda.
Well, it's sophisticated propaganda on one level, because it's, you know, they're spending an awful lot of our taxpayers' money making these films and videos about the White Helmets, who are basically, you know, a front for Al-Qaeda Syria. But of course, what's going on in Bahrain, we've heard nothing about. As I said earlier, we're going to build a new British naval base in Bahrain, even though the people of Bahrain don't want us there, to put not too fine a point.
That's what we're just hearing on the news from Tehran at the top of the hour there. More trouble in Bahrain.
That's right. And of course, the Saudis actually invaded Bahrain during the Arab Spring to crush the Bahraini demonstrators with the full support of the British and the Americans. Now, if we're going to put British sailors into Bahrain in a base, at some point that's going to turn into a war. And that means some of those British sailors are going to be absolutely legitimate targets for Bahraini patriots who are defending the sovereignty of their country. Sorry to quote Nigel Farage there, but that's what sovereignty is all about.
We're going to have a look at the whole situation in Yemen now, because maybe you could just comment before we hear this piece, Martin, about the announcement of the European Union now considering banning all weapon sales. I think it was begun by the Dutch, saying that it would be illegal to sell any Dutch weapons to Saudi Arabia because of what's happening in Yemen and the blockade and the biggest cholera outbreak since medieval times, folks. So what do you make of the EU's position here? It rather does leave Britain isolated, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And don't forget that as we speak, Theresa May is over there sucking up to the new regime in Saudi Arabia and telling them, don't have to worry. We'll back you all the way. Carry on buying our weapons, please. Now, of course, the other EU countries can say that they're going to stop selling weaponry to the Saudis because, by and large, they don't sell them that very much. But we do. We spend a lot of money on that. We get the Saudis to spend a lot of money buying our weaponry. And, of course, it keeps a lot of people in overtime, Christmas overtime, up in Filton.
OK, before we get up to date with exactly what's happening with the EU ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia, let's have a listen now to the Prime Minister's questions this week, where Ian Blackford asked about this exact point.
Ian Blackford!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the First Secretary in congratulating Prince Harry and Meghan on their engagement and wish them a long life and happiness together? And if I may, can I also welcome the moderator of the Church of Scotland, the Reverend Derek Browning, who is with us in the gallery today? Mr. Speaker, can the First Secretary of State tell the House how much money the UK government has received from arms sales from Saudi Arabia since the war with Yemen began?
Secretary!
I'm afraid I don't have the figure to hand, but I do urge the honourable gentleman to recognise the fact, first of all, that our defence industry is an extremely important creator of jobs and prosperity in Scotland as well as in other parts of the country, and that we have, because I'm obviously aware of the very terrible situation in Yemen at the moment, but this country has one of the most rigorous and robust defence sales regimes in the world. It was recognised in a court case last July, and we are absolutely determined to continue the most rigorous and robust system in place, because that's the right thing to do, both for our prosperity and to ensure we keep proper control on arms sales.
Well, that's a long time to be able not to answer the question, but I'll tell the First Secretary. The UK government has received £4.6 billion in selling arms to Saudi Arabia since the war in Yemen began, a war which has created a devastating humanitarian crisis. Yemen is now on the brink of famine, and UNICEF has said that 150,000 children will die by the end of this year. Doesn't the First Secretary agree that the best thing that the Prime Minister can do with our meetings today is follow the example of the Netherlands and suspend licences for arms sales to Saudi Arabia to stop killing children?
Secretary!
I should correct something the Right Honourable Gentleman said, that the government received money. It will be the companies that receive the money and therefore their workers. So he can take that position if he wants. It was, it's, I know, the Labour Party's position as well, but that would certainly entail significant job losses. Now, what is very, very important is not only that we have the robust regime which I talked about, but that absolutely we continue the humanitarian efforts that we make to try and alleviate the terrible conditions in Yemen. We are the fourth largest humanitarian donor to Yemen and the second largest to the UN appeal. And I would also remind him that the involvement of the Saudis in this conflict came at a request of the legitimate government of Yemen and has United Nations Security Council backing. That's why we support it. This is a conflict supported by the UN Security Council, and I would hope that the Right Honourable Gentleman will have some respect for the Security Council.
Well, obviously, you've got, I think it was an SNP MP there calling for arms sales to Saudi Arabia to be stopped, and the government, you know, playing a defensive bat, trying to carry on justifying the unjustifiable, really. We go on about terrorists threatening our way of life, attacking the Manchester arena and all the rest of it. And there was a report that the Liberal Democrats insisted was made, who was funding extremist ideology in Britain. And of course, we've not been allowed to see it because the answer was quite clear: Saudi Arabia.
Well, we were talking 2 weeks ago as well, weren't we, about this whole thing of various people who've been fighting for al-Nusra and fighting for ISIS coming back to Britain and being told, oh well, even though they've been trained as terrorists, that MI5 and the police aren't interested in interviewing them.
Well, that's because they were probably recruited by MI6 working with the Saudis in the first place, which is what people have got to understand, but they still don't understand. Britain is probably the closest country in the world to the regime in Saudi Arabia, which is now carrying out a blockade on the poorest country in the Middle East, Yemen, which is leading to massive deaths amongst children. They said 50,000 children have died as a result of this blockade, something like that. And we are directly involved in this. There was in the Daily Mail this week or the week before that, in fact, Scottish soldiers are there on the ground training the Saudis in irregular warfare. RAF personnel are helping them to carry out their bombing raids on markets and other civilian infrastructure in Yemen. We are implicated in all of this. It's every bit as reprehensible as Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait or the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, and we're implicated in it. And yet we want
to... Well, we're not just implicated in it. We're making lots of money.
Well, we're not making lots of money. As the minister pointed out, the companies are making lots of money.
Doesn't the government get tax?
Yes, they get
or
some.
Or is it mainly kickbacks?
They get tax and they get kickbacks as well. Well, of course, that's what's underlying all of this. But the fact is, there is no future for Britain's high-tech industry producing weaponry for regimes like Saudi regime, which I think the Saudi regime, at the end of the next passage of play, it ain't going to be there. It's a glass pillar. The whole Western system depends on the Saudi petrodollar deal with the US, that they will sell their oil in dollars. They're being wooed by the Chinese to sell it in yuan. And in any case, there's probably going to be some kind of internal uprising in Saudi Arabia in there. Now, so what may well happen is that we've supplied all this weaponry to Saudi Arabia. There'll be an internal rebellion. We won't get paid for the weaponry because they'll just refuse to pay us.
Oh, but they'll have export credit guarantees.
Well, no,
they?
I'm just saying, if you've got a new regime in Saudi Arabia, which comes out through revolution, which is quite possible.
Well, these arms companies know what they're doing. Yeah, but because they get guarantees for the payments.
Yes. Oh, yes. So they will get paid by the British taxpayer, but we won't have made a penny from it. And, incidentally, we then may go to war with the revolution regime in Saudi Arabia with the Americans, and our own kit will be used against our people if we do so. And that's the mess that we've got ourselves into. And ultimately, we've got to have an industrial policy, which of course we've now started talking about after 30 years of pretending we didn't need one. And what that industrial policy has to do is wean us off selling weaponry to Saudi Arabia and using those skills for something more sensible, like building a better widget for the working housewife.
Okay, so yesterday the European Union's Parliament backed the ban on Saudi weapon sales over the Yemen war. Well, let's see if the Parliament's got any teeth over the next few weeks. British MEPs have criticised the hypocritical position of the UK government, who are responsible for the largest number of arms exports to Saudi Arabia. I think it was about $3.3 billion a year, as far as I can remember. And this is just literally Alex MacDonald writing in the Middle East Eye today. Campaigners have welcomed a call by the European Parliament for an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia as the death toll in Yemen continues to mount. The resolution adopted on Thursday, MEPs called for a political solution to the conflict and a resolution to the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in the country. They also called on Iran to end its support for the Houthi rebels and an end to indiscriminate attacks on civilians.
Well, there's no evidence that the Houthi rebels are supported by Iran. In actual fact, the Iranians didn't want them to take over the capital, Sana'a, a couple of years ago, but they took no notice because they've got their own agenda.
Isn't the EU Parliament just trying to be even-handed here?
Well, what they're doing is they're trying to be even-handed, but they're getting it wrong. The so-called Houthi rebels are actually in alliance with Sunni majority people in Yemen. It's actually a war of self-defense by Yemen against Saudi Arabia. The guy who's supposedly the legitimate ruler of Saudi Arabia of Yemen is under house arrest in Saudi Arabia because they don't dare to let him go back to Yemen in case he sides with what they call the rebels. And it's pretty clear after all of the bombing and killing that's been going on that the Yemeni population does not accept Saudi domination of their country. Well, don't forget, they've got a much bigger population than Saudi Arabia. The population in Arabia is concentrated in Yemen. They're poor, but there's a lot more of them than there are Saudi. There's a few thousand Saudi princes who run Saudi Arabia, and less now because many of them have been purged. So it's an even tighter group. But Yemen is, in fact, a populous state with a large population. And if the oil wealth in Arabia was properly shared, it should be their oil wealth, and it shouldn't necessarily belong to the Saudi royal family.
OK, also Middle Eastern Eye today, Turkey has issued an arrest warrant for a former CIA officer over the last year's July attempted coup. So they're starting to identify who's actually been behind this.
Yeah.
They accused Graham Fuller of attempting to overthrow Turkey's government on the 15th of July 2016. So I imagine that the Turkish government are now rather more persuaded to be friendly with the Russians and Moscow than they are with Washington and NATO.
I think that's the case. I mean, if you try and there's been a successful coup in Zimbabwe. There was an unsuccessful coup in Turkey, which killed hundreds of people, by the way. That wasn't bloodless. And there was clearly an attempt to assassinate Erdogan. Now, I don't actually like Erdogan very much. He's a right-wing nationalist and not really to my taste.
I mean, what's wrong with him being nationalist? He's Turkish, for goodness sake.
No, the point I'm making is that he has popular support.
And what a nationalist will do in a situation like this, it's very difficult for Turkey because they're right sandwiched in the middle between two great superpowers. Surely you've got to be a nationalist in order to retain some independence.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the Kurds could say we're nationalists as well and we want a separate state in southeast Turkey where we're the majority, because they are.
Well, actually, it's much easier to take a bit of land of northern Syria for the Kurds.
Well, that's what a lot of the rowing is about, because the potential, the support for the YPG in northern Syria, as far as the Turks are concerned, they are an offshoot.
Well, we've
of
seen our local MP, Conservative MP Jack Lepresti, make a lot of visits to see the Peshmerga.
But he went to see the Iraqi Kurds, which is a different kettle of fish again. You've got to remember that the Kurds are spread out over various countries around there, so you've got different factions within each country, and then you've got different factions within the Kurdish national movement. So in actual fact, they haven't got a unified position, although they're beginning to develop one as things go forward.
I mean, the fallout from this coup attempt last year is enormous. Do you want to, I mean, I shouldn't really play guessing games, but do you want to guess the number of people who have been arrested so far over that?
It's tens of thousands.
50,000.
Yeah.
And how many people have been sacked or suspended from their jobs in the public and private
sectors?
Hundreds
of thousands.
150,000. I mean, an enormous fallout, really. And yeah. I suppose a complete rearrangement of I suppose it's Erdogan just tightening his grip on the country, really.
That's right. Well, if you try and carry out a coup against somebody and kill hundreds of people and then fail, they're likely to kick back.
What about the arrest?
That's what they do.
What about the arrest of the chair of Amnesty International, though? That's not very good, is it?
Yeah, well, that's the point. Is that the situation is not a good one. Erdogan has popular support, but he doesn't have popular support in the southeast of Turkey, the Kurdish majority regions. He lost his two-thirds majority in the Turkish parliament because the HDP, the Kurdish aligned party, managed to win quite a substantial chunk of the vote, virtually all the vote in the part of the country which they claim as their homeland. And it's all very well being a nationalist, but you can't be a nationalist with somebody else's country. It's like being an Israeli nationalist and saying, I'm an Israeli nationalist and the land of Palestine belongs to me. And but some of the Palestinians are going, I'm a Palestinian nationalist and we were here first and you can't have it. So the problem with nationalism is it's not compatible. Nationalism of all kinds basically leads to a situation where we're all fighting over the same banana, and you know that somebody's got to lose.
We haven't got anything specific on Trump this week, but it's very difficult not to mention his retweeting the Britain First tweets. Mm-hmm. There's also talk at the moment about him getting rid of Rex Tillerson.
Yes, and you know, there's an ongoing soap opera there. One interesting thing about the tweets, which I picked up this afternoon when I was looking at the internet, was that one of these tweets, which has been put up there by Britain First, is of an Islamic extremist in Syria smashing a statue of the Virgin Mary. And therefore, they're saying, isn't this terrible? Just put it this way. I mean, both Trump and Britain First are completely wrong. What they are showing is videos of people doing nasty stuff who happen to be Muslims and saying all Muslims do nasty stuff because we've got videos of people doing nasty stuff. But anyway, the nasty stuff in one of the videos is this guy smashing a picture of the Virgin, a statue of the Virgin Mary. And it turns out that he was a Free Syrian Army commander at that time, being funded by the British taxpayer to smash the picture of the Virgin Mary. And we funded that guy, and we trained his soldiers. And
isn't
now,
it right,
of course,
isn't it right for Trump to criticise him then?
I'm just pointing out that Trump did is he retweeted stuff from Britain First without finding out where it had come from, which is then, of course, causes the British government to say, hang on, you're retweeting stuff from Britain First.
And effectively, this is fake news, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. And the fact is, when Britain First put that stuff up there, and of course the leaders of Britain First were arrested by the police service of Northern Ireland not long ago for speeches that they made in Belfast on a loyalist platform. And you feel like saying, well, you like the Virgin Mary, do you? You know, that's, you're against the Virgin Mary being, you know, they should have told their loyalist friends about that. But anyway, the fact is that this is Trump, as President of the United States, A, shouldn't be messing around retweeting Britain First stuff. He ought to have more important things to do. And secondly, you cannot. I could show a picture of a white person smashing somebody with a baseball bat and say, look, that's what white people do. They hit people with baseball bats. Doesn't prove anything, does it?
You would have thought that surely Trump has got people around him who would advise him this is not the wisest thing to do. But he hasn't actually retracted, has he?
No, he doubled down on it and said Theresa May should concentrate more on radical Islam in Britain than having a go at him. And he doesn't really understand British culture at all, which is this stiff upper lip thing. Is we don't like people accused. You know, no, most people in Britain are sensible enough to realise that the vast majority
of the Muslim
community.
Surely he's right to say that we need to keep an eye on radical Islam. The police and MI5 don't seem to want to.
Well, if we're going to talk about keeping an eye on radical Islam, let's talk about the guy in the tweet, in the video, who was actually funded by the British and US intelligence services. And we should actually find out who gave them the funding, put them on trial and send them to prison.
So
25
it's
years.
It's almost like the intelligence services having a go at themselves.
Well, indeed.
Via Donald Trump.
Indeed. And of course, what's actually happening is it's all getting more and more bizarre because they keep pushing this idea that the Muslims are out to get us, but the most extreme radical Muslims in Syria, Saudi Arabia and elsewhere are our closest allies and have been for 30 or 40 years. You feel like people, don't you realise the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has been based in Manchester since the 1980s and they've been working very closely with MI5 and MI6 to overthrow Gaddafi. That's why they're there. That's why the guy knew how to build a bomb, because he was probably taught how to build a bomb by our own operatives at our expense.
And we had Graham Fawkes on here a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, who lost his son in the 7/7 bombings, saying the same people who were responsible for supposedly security in Britain during the 7/7 bombings in 2005 allowed the Manchester attack to happen with exactly the same sorts of mistakes, and they're still running the show.
Yes, and it's not just making mistakes either. the evidence of what's happened in Libya and Syria, and I know we're going to come on to Libya later in the show, is that the Western intelligence services and special forces, including SAS and others, have been directly involved with working with Islamist terrorists in the Middle East and elsewhere. And of course, the suspicion has to be that these attacks in Britain and elsewhere are false flag attacks being run from inside our own intelligence services. And people say, oh, they wouldn't be doing that. They just don't know what they're talking about. The evidence is overwhelming that Western intelligence services, via the Saudis, have been working with the most extreme elements of Sunni radical Islam, and also just general crazies from prisons and so on who happen to be Muslim but are, you know, mercenaries for these forces. And we've been working with them not just in the 1980s, but right recently. You know, SAS have been inside Syria in the recent months, working exactly with these people to teach them how to kill Syrian soldiers at our expense. And then we're also told, well, this is one of the reasons why I think they've been allowed to come back without being interrogated and so on, because their defence, if they were put on trial coming back from Syria, is, yes, but you recruited us in the first place.
Okay, so now ISIS and al-Nusra are facing defeat. It does seem, at least according to various news outlets, are, and I'll put the link up to this on our show page. This one is on the anti-media, but it's got a link to a mainstream news. Jason Ditz, actually, no, it's not mainstream, it's antiwar.com. But apparently, the Pentagon is sending thousands of more troops to Iraq and Syria and is lying to us about it, he says. When the Pentagon talks numbers in Syria and Iraq, it's always the same. There are 503 US troops in Syria and 5,000 in Iraq. It doesn't matter that thousands more troops are known to have been added since those figures were invented, but they're still talked about as current. At least as current as the reporters ever get. The Defence Manpower Data Centre, however, has to offer quarterly reports on US deployment and appears not to have the luxury of just fabricating numbers to suit the narrative, which reveals what we already knew. The Pentagon's reported figures meant that for the American public were flat-out lies. In reality, there are around about 9,000 troops in Iraq and 2,000 in Syria, and the numbers have only risen since September.
Well, they've got no basis in Syria whatsoever. They've got no UN Security Council resolution, and they've got no invite from the Syrian government.
And they've got no permission from whether it's Congress or the British Parliament to be.
No,
there.
They haven't. So they've got in every possible way you can think of, US forces in Syria are illegal.
What are they doing there?
They're there to try and destabilise the Middle East in the favour of the Israeli interests and the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex in the West. There's no legal basis for it. And, of course, if all of those guys came home in boxes, nobody could complain.
Okay, what about this news? What about this news from the Middle East Monitor, then, this week, that China is to deploy troops to fight along Assad in Syria?
Well, we're now seeing the development of the alliances which World War III will be based around. And, of course, the Chinese are being provoked in the South China Sea. They're also being provoked by the North Korean crisis, which is not being handled by the Americans in a way to get the Chinese on side. And so the Chinese, who basically just want to do business, are coming round to the Russian view, which is we're going to have to fight the West, aren't we, because we can't talk to them. That's where we've got ourselves.
In a way, of course, this is a sort of UN force that's arrived in Syria with Russian and Chinese troops.
No, it's not a UN force.
Well, what I'm saying is it's because of the failure of the United Nations, the big superpowers have had to come in and say, well, actually, we're not going to allow the West to take Syria and not going to allow regime change by any means in that country. And so we're bringing our troops in there.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what's happening. But
what the UN should be doing, surely.
Well, it's been suggested by the Russians that the UN could be involved in the end game in Syria and also in Ukraine, but that would require consensus, which doesn't exist as far as we can see at the moment. And of course, what's beginning to happen because of all the bad faith by the West, that, you know, they say one thing and then do another. Erdogan's lost patience with that as well. You know, they say there's only one thing worse than being America's enemy, and that's being America's friend. And of course, you've now reached a point where basically nobody trusts the word of Western politicians. And at that point, they make their own plans without taking into account what we might or might not want.
Okay, another story this week from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. This is on the 28th of November. The media have erased the NATO role in bringing slave markets to Libya. This is a story by Ben Norton. 21st century slave markets, human beings sold for a few hundred dollars, massive protests throughout the world. The American and British media have awakened to the grim reality in Libya, where African refugees are for sale in open-air slave markets. Yet a crucial detail in this scandal has been downplayed or even ignored by the corporate media. The role of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in bringing slavery to the North African nation.
Well, if you think about back to the fighting in Libya a few years ago, do you remember the story that Gaddafi's forces had African mercenaries fighting for them who'd been given Viagra so that they could carry out rapes? And Amnesty International and other serious organizations gave this kind of story credibility. Now, in actual fact, what you've got in Libya is a black minority, which has always lived in Libya. So Tawerga, which is near Misrata, I think, was virtually a black town because it was historically a black Libyan town. And all of those people were disappeared at the end of the war. Nobody knows what's happened to them. They're probably in mass graves. Because, of course, the rebels that we were supporting in Libya weren't the lovers of freedom and democracy that we were told. They were Al-Qaeda Libya, which, of course, we'd been working with since the 1980s when Shaler and Machon showed that MI6 were working with them in order to assassinate Gaddafi, which is why they quit MI5. It was an MI6 plot, which killed a load of people but didn't kill Gaddafi. But, of course, they were working with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which also provided, per head, the biggest contingent that fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s, particularly the people from Benghazi. So, in other words, we've been working with those people for years, and the Libyans were then trained by our own special forces, SAS, etc., Green Berets, and then sent to Afghanistan and then subsequently all over the world. And I think what the Russian general staff have concluded is that virtually all of these jihadi groups are working directly or indirectly with the Saudis and the Western intelligence services. And that's pretty much the case as far as
okay,
anybody can see.
Let's finish tonight, though, with the attack of, they reckon, about 300 people killed in an Egyptian mosque last weekend. Absolutely horrific, as militants, described as militants, attacked a crowded mosque during Friday prayers, this time last week in the Sinai Peninsula, setting off explosives, spraying worshippers with gunfire and killing, well, they said, this is CBS saying, at least 235 people in the deadliest ever attack by Islamic extremists. But no one's claimed this attack, Martin. Can you just tell us who's got the means and motive to do this? It just seems incredible to, I find it difficult to believe that even Islamist terrorists could sit outside a mosque just machine gunning everyone inside and outside.
Well, I think if you go to Pakistan or Iraq, you'll see this happening daily. This has happened in Egypt, in Sinai, so it's news. But if it was happening in Baghdad or Karachi...
So who's the means and motive to do this?
Well, you've got to think about who's...
What's the geography of Sinai?
Who's been targeted? It was a Sufi mosque. And the Sufis are a particularly quietist brand of Islam. And the more extreme fundamentalist Sunnis in particular regard them as heretics, so which is why they're regarded as legitimate targets by those people. Now, they would be the most obvious people to point the finger at in this case, but you'd thought that if they were the perpetrators, they would have put their hands up and said, we were the perpetrators, because that's what they would want to do, because, you know, they hate Sufis and they want to kill them. The fact that nobody's claimed it means that it could be a false flag attack by somebody trying to destabilise the Egyptians. And who would be the most likely people to be doing that?
Well, who's got access to Sinai?
I would suggest the Israelis. That we don't know. We can't presume anything. But would they do stuff like that? Definitely. Did they do it? We don't know.
I suppose it's feasible that a small unit could... travel back across the Sinai and get back into Israel.
Don't forget, there is clear evidence that the Israeli military have been cooperating with jihadi groups beyond their borders, beyond their immediate borders in Syria, for example. So they could easily, and the jihadi groups don't necessarily know who's pulling their own strings. We don't know what happened here. It's obviously a horrific event, and to be condemned. We should condemn all such attacks, whoever carries them out. They've got no justification, and that should be absolutely clear to all of our listeners.
It just seems
always condemned.
It's a little bit like the horrific bomb in Somalia, in Mogadishu, a month and a half ago or so. You do think that there needs to be some proper investigation of who's done this, because it's quite clearly not who we're being told it was immediately straight away. And this time we're just being told, oh, well, this is Islamic militants, and there's really no evidence for that at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if it is Islamic militants, coming back to what I was saying earlier in this broadcast, there's convincing evidence, which you believe, for example, by the Russian general staff, and they've got their reasons for believing it, that these Islamic militants are being directed by intelligence services, the Saudis and the Western intelligence services. The idea seems to be,
as soon as anything horrific happened, to just attach the word Islam to it in some manner.
Indeed. And of course, it's a way of trying to create chaos and confusion. It's a strategy of tension, which we saw operated on a relatively small scale in places like Italy in the 1970s, and is now being operated on a global scale with a much bigger casualty list.
Thanks, Martin. Time to sign off now for, well, we're going to actually have another hour's worth of an interview that I've done recently with an author about Rudolf Hess. But coming up, an exclusive interview with this mysterious flight in May 1941 of Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess to Scotland. His long incarceration in Berlin's Spandau jail, being suicided there, most people agree, including his family, in 1988, just before the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall. And you can hear that on this live stream and a podcast at Radio 4 All later tonight. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for Knowle, leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Also, you just heard Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment pages, one word, thisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. I'll leave you with some music. Zero B Module Remix from 1993. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.